WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've all heard the stories about asking for directions in a rural area and being told to just go down the road a piece, then turn left at what used to be Mabel Horton's barn, and then go to where the old church once stood before lightning struck and it burnt down, and then make a right and pull in where Farmer Jones used to graze his sheep. All of those things are landmarks, and for centuries before GPS navigation or even street or highway signs, that's how people found their way from place to place. It's also how Native Americans navigated the network of trails they used for commerce and other things to find things like hunting and fishing grounds. Some of their landmarks were impossible to spot by the uninitiated because many of them were trees. In fact, even modern tribal leaders were clueless, the secret of the trees being lost to the ages. But in 2007, a group of people from four states met in northwest Arkansas to share information about Indian trail trees, some of which exist today, and an effort to find and preserve them was underway. This hour, we're going to follow the trail of those trees with Don Wells, author of Mystery of the Trees, Native American Markers of a Cultural Way of Life That Soon May Be Gone. He joins us by phone from Jasper, Georgia. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Mr. Wells wrote that book along with several others, including Lamar Marshall, who is also with us. He is a member of the, I think this is Ikota Cherokee Tribe of Alabama, and a conservationist who founded both Wild South and Wild Alabama, both forest protection organizations, and he's in the studios of WCQS in Asheville. Thank you for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
Now, these trees, which were used as trail markers by earlier generations of Native Americans, were unknown to many of today's tribal leaders. But given the oral tradition of Native cultures, why did the existence and the meaning of these trees fall into obscurity among Native Americans? Lamar, let me start with you.
Well, I'll tell you, that'd be a good question for Don. He's done more research on that. But my expertise is in actually mapping the trails.
Yeah, and what we have found, Don, is, and particularly when Columbus arrived in 1492 and all the Europeans started to come into the New World, if you will, they brought with them a lot of disease. They brought with them an attitude of indigenous people were of no value, and therefore they could push them out of the way or kill them or whatever. And so in about 400 years since Columbus arrived, after 400 years after Columbus arrived, 90% of the indigenous people were lost or gone, killed off, died off. And with them, a great number of elders had gone. And the elders were the keeper of the tribal traditions and culture, and everything was handed down orally. So when you lose the elders, you lose the culture. And that's pretty much what has happened over time with a lot of other things going on. But many of the current tribal members don't know about this. A few do, and they are talking to us and telling us about it, but there's just so many that don't know it anymore.
So if I understand this correctly, the chain of events here, Don, you are the president of the Mountain Stewards Conservation Group, and you and three other men got together and started talking about these strangely shaped trees. Did you know what they were? Did you have an inkling of what they were when you got together in 2007 and launched in this project?
Actually, the Mountain Stewards was formed in 2003, and
okay.
It's a nonprofit 501c organization similar to Lamar's, which is also a 501c3 called Wild South. Actually, we started with a bunch of old men walking and hiking trails in North Georgia in what is called the very end of the Southern Appalachian Mountains, and we were mapping trails and the hope to open those trails up, which we have done some of that. And we kept seeing these oddly shaped trees, and then the next day you'd see another one, and almost identical. And you got to thinking, well, something, I mean, this is not something that nature does, bends every tree the same way. So we found a small book written by a lady by the name of Elaine Jordan from Ellijay, Georgia, who had started studying these trees, and she was the first one who wrote something down about it. And so we worked with her and were mentored by her, and she just encouraged us to really take off on this. So we started putting some of the tree pictures up on our website, mountainstewards.org, and that led us to the people out in Hobbs State Park, where we all met a number of us from Kansas, from Arkansas, from Missouri, from Georgia, and other places. And we met, and all of us were kind of working on this. The Mountain Stewards were a little ahead of the game in that we had already put up a website on the stuff, and we had started filming information about these trees and trying to make a documentary, and we're still working on that. And that got it all started, and from there on it took off like a rocket. And once we put it up on the website in 2007, full bore, and people from all over the country started joining in, we went from having identified maybe 150 trees to today we have about 1,865 trees identified in 39 states.
Hmm. We have some pictures of these trees up on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalk, so you can get an idea of what we're talking about, because these trees, when you look at the pictures, are obviously not, unless some quirk of nature came along, one tree or two trees might be a natural thing, but the numbers of trees that we're finding here, of course, would indicate that they were actually bent to look this particular way. And Lamar, as a trail mapper, how many of these have you seen firsthand over the course of several years?
At least 100. I experienced the same thing that Don did in North Alabama, where I lived in the Bankhead National Forest. I worked with a group of Native Americans who showed me the trees. They were very unusual. And one day, Don visited a trading post that I ran down there and said, hey, we're doing this big project on trees. And so we kind of pooled our mapping and knowledge, and I began, I've been mapping Cherokee trails and Muscogee trails for several years. I work with the Trail of Tears Association in mapping Indian trails. So this just all fit together like a glove that we work together.
Are these trees that you mentioned, there are 1,800 some of these trees that you know about, are they all over the country? Are they confined to one part of the country, mostly to the southeast? Or how would you describe the locations of these trees?
Well, I mean, in the eastern, let's say east of the Mississippi River, well, maybe not quite east of it, because we got to get into Arkansas and a few others. But the trees from that part, maybe Arkansas, Missouri, eastward, are mostly white oak, red oak, a few others, poplars, that are bent. When you get beyond that area into the plain states, there's not many oaks left in that area, a few, and they switch to a ponderosa pine. And they started bending ponderosa pine. We found those in Colorado and up into the north areas from there, that mostly the Utes and other tribes from that area did that. And then you get down into the Comanche Nation. And since they were a migratory group and they were on horseback, they were looking for the best campsites. And what they would do is take a pecan tree another type, and they would bend it almost like into a half moon and tie it down, and that would mark a campsite. It was flat where they could put their teepees up. It had water from a river, and generally they wanted something that had some high bluffs around that they could put lookouts on. And so we're finding those trees in Texas and Oklahoma and places like that. We have a group in Texas that are really spending a lot of time searching for those. And so they're quite different. And then down particularly where Lamar was in Alabama, and we found elsewhere, there are witness trees, which are smooth skin trees that the Indians would carve symbols on. Only they knew what they spoke about. But they would have a message on that tree. And so we found many of those in the southeast, but we're also finding some of them up into the northeast, amongst the Northeast tribes. And then further out west, there is the ponderosa pines, where they what they called a culturally modified tree. They would take the tree and carve out a piece of the inner and outer bark, maybe about 2 feet wide by 4 or 5 feet tall, and they would get to the next layer, which is the cadmium layer, and in there they would scrape that off, and they would eat it. That would be, in the wintertime, that would be something that would sustain them.
Mm-hmm.
And we find those trees all over the western and northwestern part of the United States, which shows us where the campsites were. When they were there, they would use those trees to sustain themselves. So there's all kind of stuff all over the nation.
So this practice of bending trees is something that goes from tribe to tribe to tribe to tribe. It wasn't just peculiar to one or two or three tribes in a certain part of the country. Could one tribe, if you had taken a tribe member of the Cherokees, for instance, and put them out west, would they have been able to read the tree bending, the bent trees in that part of the country, or would they have been bent in a different way for a different purpose and be unintelligible to somebody from a different part of the country?
I think they did. If you follow particularly the Cherokees, after the Revolutionary War, where they had sided with the British, they got their hands slapped and half their territory was taken away. And at that point, around 1790 or so, they started migrating westward, and they wound up in what was now what we would call the Arkansas Territory. And they did again in 1808 and 1807, and then finally the Turkeytown Treaty of 1817, where a lot of land was transferred, and a large number of Cherokees moved into Arkansas. And we have found hundreds and hundreds of bent trees in Arkansas. What we understand, too, is that in the Trail of Tears, where they crossed through Arkansas, that if you look at the numbers, there's about several thousand Cherokees that disappeared off the Trail of Tears that they cannot account for. And what we believe is that they were reading the trees as they went by, and some of those trees mark water, some of them mark shelter or safe places, and they could slide off of the thing and get lost and not show up again, and stayed there. And some of them came back all the way back to the East Coast. So we know they were reading the trees, and some of the elders have talked to us about how these trees mark different things, mark trails, mark graves, mark water, mark stream crossing.
Can we, Lamar, read the trees yet? Do we know precisely what some of these trees are indicating?
A lot of them are, like the title of the book says, a mystery of the trees. Some of them we do know that point down to water and to shelter. The other form of witness trees that Don referred to was the primarily they use beech trees, big old beech trees, and these trees lived to be 400, 500, 600 years old. The Indians had a universal sign language of gestures that they could communicate. All the tribes could communicate, the Cherokees with the Western Indians, and they developed a pictographic form of writing, and they actually peeled pine trees, and they took black and red vermilion and charcoal-based paints, and they put messages on these trees, and they could read them like a newspaper. They were far more advanced than what you'd think as far as communications. And the trail network, actually, it was a major trail network, connected the Atlantic to the Pacific and the Gulf to the Arctic.
We have to stop at this point. Well, I want to come back and talk about this trail network, because that's a revelation to a lot of people. It's like super highways all over the country long before the Europeans got here. We'll come right back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Good morning. It's about 9:20, and you're tuned to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Erin Sutton. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and Opera Carolina, performing Puccini's Tosca October 13th, 18th, and 21st at the Belk Theater. For more information, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. And from Cannon School, hosting an admission open house where students, teachers, and leaders show what learning looks like in the life of a Cannon student. Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. and Saturday, November 3rd at 1 p.m. canonschool.org. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, author and historian Kevin Duffus believes he has found Blackbeard the Pirate's treasure, but his discovery may surprise you. Find out why when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Supreme Court is expected to take up affirmative action, same-sex marriage, and voting rights this term. What's ahead for the nation's highest court?
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. Join us.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about trees that were used by the Native Americans to mark trails and other landmarks that they would need to live their lives in the forests of North America. Don Wells is with us. He, along with Diane Wells and Dr. John Nardo, Robert Wells and Lamar Marshall, our other guest, have written a book called Mystery of the Trees, and I'm hoping that the subtitle here is not a misprint, Don. It says Native American Makers of a Cultural Way of Life That Soon May Be Gone. Is it makers or markers?
A mistake. It's marker.
It's a typo. I thought it might be.
Oh, and it's one of those things that got missed after five people looked at the book. We still missed it.
Been there. Understand that. Also with us, Lamar Marshall, who's a conservationist with the Cherokee Tribe, founder and cultural heritage director of Wild South and Wild Alabama. And just before the break, Lamar, you were talking about this network, this extensive network of Native American trails that went from the East Coast to the West Coast and then North and South as well. And I guess they were all interconnected. Could Native Americans travel them in peace, or were they just trails that individual tribes had developed and somehow connected together and you were taking your life in your hands if you went into somebody else's territory?
Well, this trail system was a long an evolution, I'm sure. Of course, we had the wood bison and the elk were the largest animals that traveled across these mountains and the plains of the Carolinas and other states that formed the major trailways. And, of course, they followed the paths of least resistance, and they went across the shallowest places of the rivers where they forded, and they went over the lowest mountain gaps. Then combined with the Cherokees and other tribes, they just evolved from town to town. They warred. So they use these trails to go to war. They use these trails to go to their hunting grounds, which are usually in the higher mountains in this part of the state. And, of course, connected all of our towns and settlements together. Mm-hmm. And I would say that our modern transportation system in the United States is laid down on a network of Aboriginal or Native American trails that were here long before any European ever set foot on this continent.
So we just laid the highways over the trails or parallel to the trails. We followed the trails.
Well, the way it works, and I've studied this extensively, I'm in our third year of mapping for the eastern band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina, is we pulled every historical map that's known to show native trails for 100 years of maps, every early survey, every primary source that you can find that refers to these trails. And they began, the Cherokees would go straight up over mountains to a gap. And when the British came, they complained that the Indians went straight over the mountains where they wanted to go obliquely. So these foot trails became wagon roads. When they did that, they had to, you know, put switchbacks in. So what started out as trails that flowed naturally with the contours of the land, they became switchbacked when you got wagons. And then, of course, today we don't follow the natural contours of the land. We just blast the mountains away with the modern interstate system. Right.
I think it's interesting that you talk on the one hand about the Native Americans developing these trails that followed the natural contours and went through rivers and streams at the shallowest point and made it easy to go up the mountainsides, except for the Cherokees, because they really did take the steep route over slippery rocks and things like that the British really didn't know how to navigate. Why did the Cherokees go straight up the mountain as opposed to doing their own version of switchbacks or finding more gentle slopes? It must have been pretty strenuous on them.
The Cherokee were one of the hardiest tribes of Native Americans in the United States. When Grant's army came in 1761, the British came in. They burned all the middle, lower, and out-town Cherokee settlements. They couldn't have done what they did without bringing in Catawba scouts, Chickasaw scouts, and Mohawks and other Indians to actually try to find the Cherokees. Once several Cherokees were cornered over near Cowee on the Little Tennessee River when the army got there, and they caught a couple of them, but the Cherokees hit the woods, and the other Indians couldn't catch them either, and the British complained that, or recorded in their journal, that not even their Indians could catch these Cherokees who were so hardy. They could run for hours. There are records where a Cherokee man ran up beside a British soldier, and they rode 3 hours straight, wide open, and that Cherokee just galloped along beside of him. So they were incredibly hardy.
Now, these trails, and we have, as I mentioned earlier, we have some pictures of these trails up on our website, and we've also put a link to your website on our website so people can understand what we're talking about when we talk about these trail trees that are these strangely shaped trees, so people can go look at them. And we have a web comment from a guy who identifies himself as News Geek, who said he just wanted to say that his 1970s-era copy of the Boy Scout Handbook had information about this very topic, and he's seen trees like this on many of his hikes in North Carolina. Were you aware that the Boy Scout Handbook in the 1970s had these trees?
Well, I'm not aware of that one, but I do know we have books that were written back in the 1940s and even before that that have pictures of them, and also news articles that people have. When we did the research for the book, we have 106 bibliography sites in there, and went back and found everything that was written that we could find that identified these things, because of the fact that the Native Americans didn't have a lot of knowledge of it. So we've been doing that. One thing I wanted to go back to and mention on the trail business is that Lamar and I and our team, what we do is we find the old maps that Lamar mentioned, and we get those maps geo-referenced onto an Earth model, which in this case would be Google Earth, and then we can extract the trail data off. And then Lamar and I go in to find the trail, and we find out where it has crossed a natural feature like an existing road of today. If the trail is still there, we can then start walking on that trail, and we use our GPS to record the exact trail location and then compare it to what we did off the maps. If they coincide, then it's a validation of the trail is. And we've done that in particularly in Oconee County, South Carolina, and in Georgia and in North Carolina, where we've been working for the Cherokees for the last 3 years. And now we have trails mapped from doing this process from North Carolina through South Carolina, all of Georgia, and half of Alabama.
We have
thousands and thousands of miles of trails mapped, some of which have been validated by us walking them.
When you go through to the forest, I mean, how do you know you're on a trail? Because obviously, if the trail hasn't been used
It's actually there. When you know some of those pictures we sent you. When you walk up, and there is a slight indention, in some cases just like a small U-shaped, if the trail became a wagon trail for the pioneers, and they drove wagons or mule trains, if you will, over those trails, then it sort of got dug out a little further, and you would see this kind of a U-shaped trail. And you could always tell it because they would pick the rocks up out of the center of the trail and pile them on the side. And when you see the rocks piled up on the side, as Lamar and I have seen numerous times, you know that this is the trail they were using. And we followed those trails. In fact, the one from South Carolina we followed for about from over in Oconee County all the way up to Highlands, North Carolina. And then over the side from there, it goes down, and we followed parts of that, which we could get to, all the way down to Franklin. And then from there, we've mapped them out over into Tennessee. So not all these trails are there because land has been disturbed. But when you can find them, it's just absolutely neat to walk down an old trail that's been there for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You say that some of these trails are, some of these trees are clearly marking or pointing to the trail. They line up with the path of the trail.
Right.
But plenty of others of these trees evidently do not. Do we have any idea how the ones that don't were meant to function?
What we find is particularly like in Lamar was tracking a trail from Robbinsville, North Carolina, to the west, and found a tree marking an old Indian trail that we've known been there for a long time, and it was pointing directly along the tree. Others point, if you will, perpendicular to the trail, and those are normally marking water. And we have found in a number of cases where we find a tree pointing off, if you just sort of follow it down just a little ways, you'll find a spring or a river or some kind of place that they could get. And when they were out for thousands of miles on these trails, they had to stop and find water and other things or shelter. And so these trees are doing that. When we find them individually, it's very questionable as to, okay, what is it really marking? And we wait to find numerous trees in an alignment. And we've done that particularly in Lumpkin County, Georgia. We found where there was no trail marked on any of the maps, but when we found about eight trees, all of in a kind of a straight alignment, you begin to say, okay, this is one of the trails that they followed.
Do we know how they, do we know were these trees bent, do we know, by a particular kind of Native American or a particular kind of person within the tribe, or would this have been done by any member of the tribe as they found a spring and they thought, we need
to
mark this?
I think it's probably men doing it, and they bent them as a sapling. That's the only time they could bend them, and and they would sometimes put a fork yoke is like a yoke point to bend it so to make the 90-degree bend. And then that tree had to sit there after it was tied down for about a year to get locked into that position or that characteristic, and then they would come back and either bend the vertical up or take the first vertical going up and then cut off anything past that. And then they would form a nose on it, and the nose had all kind of different shapes that have probably some kind of meaning, but we don't understand.
We don't know. Yeah, because you talk about how some of these trees mark the trail. Some of them point to water, to shelter, to stream crossings, to medicine plant sites. Do they look substantially different in the way they were bent or the trees they chose to use for things other than marking the trail? Or are they pretty much the same, or can we tell?
Actually, they're not the same, and we don't know because nobody knows anymore why one tree is bent. A lot of trees are bent horizontal, but then we have some that are bent another 45 degrees downward. And so what do those mean? And we know from some of the tribes that the trees mark graves, particularly like the Ho-Chunk Nation up in Wisconsin area. They were a migratory group, and when they would move from one area, anybody that was buried there, they would bend a tree to mark those graves, so when they came back, they would know where they were. So we just don't know. And some of the trees have little appurtenances on them and that, you know, in a pattern. You know, there's obviously a message on a message, but we just do not know what they mean.
You know, when you do, if we were to try to do this today, it would seem to me that although we could perhaps control the angle of the bend, and if we tied it down long enough, the tree would stay that way and grow in that shape until it died. But there were also things you could not control about how that tree adapted to this new growing pattern. So could they control what these trees ultimately completely looked like so that they could be easily read by members of the tribe or other Native Americans passing through? Or were they sometimes just going to do what the trees were going to do, what they were going to do, no matter what you did to them?
I think they had some control. We don't know again, but we are speculating that they knew something about grafting. And because some of the trees look obviously that they had to know how to graft a limb to put it where they wanted to put it. The appearances of them, obviously they knew a lot about how to do this. And it was, you know, universally shared amongst the many tribes. we just, you know, it's unfortunately, it's one of those things why we call it the mystery, because we really would love to know what they all meant.
When the Europeans came here, they came here with a great deal of ego, and they came here, as we look back on them, looking at these Native Americans as being a subspecies or ignorant or not capable of learning. What, as we investigate this network of trails that crisscross this vast continent and these trail markers and the trees that they bent to show where water was, what does it say about Native American society of that time?
They were far more wise than many of us today. I can say tell you that right now. There wouldn't be a Charlotte Talks either, by the way, if Charlotte hadn't grown up on an intersection of two major, not Cherokee, but maybe Catawba or other trails. One of the most major trails in the southeast was, now we know it as the Great Wagon Road, and a lot of our ancestors came down this road. But it began at the Port of Philadelphia, came down through Pennsylvania, through Virginia, and it went through Salisbury and then through Charlotte. Well, Charlotte was a crossroads, and that was a great place to be. I mean, you can imagine being settling along a road, and you could only go north or south. But if you got a crossroad, you can go east and west. Well, this great trail went into South Carolina and joined the Charlestown Trading Path, the great Cherokee Trading Path, and eventually went to Augusta. So this they're pretty amazing. And the trees, when you see them, are a phenomena. I mean, when you see it, you know you're looking at a trail marker tree. Mm-hmm. They're not natural, and I can tell you that we haven't even talked about the double trail marker trees yet.
Well, I was about to get to that, because some of these trees have several bends in them, and one of them I saw a photograph in your book. It almost looks like a goalpost.
That is the it's a sacred tree to the Cherokees in North Alabama. That's found in the Bankhead National Forest in Indian Tomb Hollow, where there was a battle. The legend says that this big goalpost or marker tree pointed to the graves of the people that were killed in this battle. Now, we're finding two sets of these trees. We found a set up on the Kuala boundary of two trail marker trees side by side, which was very unusual. One day we were driving down near Dillard, between Dillard and Franklin, along a corridor of an old Cherokee trail, and off to the side of the road I saw two big trail marker trees. And it's like, what in the world they did on this road that apparently has been cut out of the mountainside here? They can't be. I mean, what do they say? Don and company, we went up and parked on the side of the road, and we're looking at these two big trail marker trees and trying to figure out why they're on this paved road. We saw a woman in a wheelchair came fast as she could down a driveway from the woods, and she said, "Y'all are looking at the Indian trail marker trees." And we were like, "Yes." And she said, "There used to be two more of them up my driveway. There was an Indian trail came over the ridge here and was down to the ford on the Little Tennessee River to Senti Town," which is an Indian town located right there. So we found at least three pair of double trail marker trees, and Don may know of many more.
And the goalpost tree, we have some of the goalposts in Georgia. And we think they're boundary markers in some cases. The one in the Bankhead is one of the most special ones that Lamar mentioned, is the grave marker probably. But again, we don't know why. But we have some with two and some with three and four verticals. And we have a number of them that are, like Lamar mentioned, the one on the Kuala boundary is two together. And there's two also over in southwest Missouri.
Don,
right together.
Don Wells is president of Mountain Stewards Conservation Group and the author of Mystery of the Trees, along with Lamar Marshall. We'll come right back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
9:40, and you're tuned in to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. We're coming right back. Support this morning comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Fall finale on Saturday, October 13th, featuring an oyster roast and live music from Acoustic Syndicate, the David Mayfield Parade, and Sons of Bill, usnwc.org. And from Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, presenting the new 2013 Subaru models, including the XV Crosstrek, an all-wheel drive crossover built for all-terrain and fuel efficiency. More information at TyndallSubaru.com. Coming up next on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear cases on affirmative action and same-sex marriage in the new term, and is likely to take up voting rights. We'll take a look at what's ahead in the nation's highest court. That's the Diane Rehm Show, ahead at 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
Hi, this is Guy Raz. You have the opportunity to help shorten WFAE's fall pledge drive. Every $55,000 listeners contribute will buy back a day of the fund drive. So please go to WFAE.org, select the Contribute Now tab, and make your pledge. You can help reduce the number of days of the WFAE pledge drive and help pay for the news and information you depend on. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Lamar Marshall is conservationist with the Yakota Cherokee Tribe and founder and cultural heritage director of Wild South and Wild Alabama. He helped write parts of Don Wells' book, Mystery of the Trees, Native American Markers of a Cultural Way of Life That Soon May Be Gone. Don is a Mountain Stewards Conservation Group president. The subtitle of your book, May Soon Be Gone, indicates that obviously trees are living things and they eventually have a lifespan and they do go away. Does it surprise you that as many of these trees, and you talked about thousands of them being in existence, are still, in fact, in existence after all this time?
Well, the ones particularly on the East Coast are white oak. White oak live about 300-350 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we are at a point about 180 years since the Cherokees and other tribes from the East Coast were moved to Oklahoma. So the trees that remain are still within their normal lifespan, but they are dying off, and we are finding many of them that are dying, and particularly when we've cored some of them to age them, when the trees die from the center out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get inside and you find that there's that early part of the growth of the tree is gone, it's hard to date them, but they're dying. And some of them have been cut down because of urban development. Some of them have been maliciously destroyed, and we have found that to be the case in a few places. So we're just trying to protect them, and particularly with regard to that, the National Historical Preservation Laws do not protect living artifacts. And so we are trying, part of what we're trying to do is get enough information together that we can convince the Congress that the law needs to be changed to protect these trees, because they are very sacred to the Indians, and they need to be protected.
Did they choose these trees, the particular species of trees that they used for this purpose, did they choose them because they knew they were long-lived trees, because these signs would have to last a very long time, or did they just choose the nearest tree that they thought could be used?
I think it's the first chapter of the book. We identified the number of trees or the species of trees that they had chosen or which we have found.
Mm-hmm.
And they obviously knew, again, as Lamar mentioned, that the Indians were really smart, and way smarter than anybody gave them credit for. And they knew how to do this. They knew how to choose which tree would last long, and they would only choose those that would last. And so even out west, like the ponderosa pine, it lasts for 600 years. So many of those will still be around for a long period of time. So it was just a piece of their knowledge.
Yeah, that makes it. We can identify the age of trees because we can go and take a core sample and look at the tree rings. It makes
right.
you wonder how they, because a 600-year-old tree, you've only been around for 30 years. How do you know it's going to live 600
well, we
years?
Don't. There's particularly the post oaks, which last even longer than the white oaks. They'll go up into 450, 500 years, and so some of the ones up in north-central parts of our country. There's a post oak up in Akron, Ohio, that's 450 years old. It's well known to be what's called the portal tree or the candelabra tree. It's specially bent, and the Indians would come down and see that tree and then pick their canoes out of this one river, move over a mile or two, get in another river, and they could work their way on down to the Mississippi. And even after they left, the settlers knew the same thing, and they would use that tree to mark where to get out. So, and what we're finding in Texas, that we're finding a number of post oak trees in Texas that are bent, that are of those age groups. And so they just knew and knew which one to bend.
Do we know how they tied them down to make those bends? They didn't have ropes, did they?
Well, they had hide. They would take hide and make string out of the hide, and particularly the elders. One of the elders, Jerry Wolf from the Eastern Band of Cherokee, he was talking about that, that when they traveled, they had all the needs, and they could tie the tree down and then keep coming back to keep checking on it as they would go up and down those trails all the time.
How long would it take for a tree to become useful? In other words, you tie it, you see a tree that you want to use, you tie it down to shape it. And you said it would take at least a year for the tree to acclimate.
Once you tie it down and get it going, then you obviously got a pointer, but not a complete pointer. But I think it took 2 to 3 years for it to be managed, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it would be in its final form.
Did they use different breeds of trees for different purposes? In other words, one breed of trees to mark trails, another to mark water sources, or did they just bend the tree that they thought would be useful to them?
And they used what the tree that was in their area that would have a long life, and for like in my world of North Georgia, the white oak is the primary tree that we find, although we do see some red oak and some poplar, but... That's what they used. They knew that tree would work, and they would bend that tree. And
I think, Lamar, it was you that talked about several of these trees having many bends in them, several different limbs going in different odd-shaped directions, which would not be natural by any means. We have no clue about why the multiple bends. I mean, would one bend indicate a trail, another a water source, another a burial ground, et cetera, or do we have any clue at all?
Well, I think what I was referring to was the fact that there were two trail marker trees side by side. It was multiple trees. As far as the bends, the vast majority of them just have two 90-degree bends that I've seen, and then the goalposts are exceptional. And as far as some of these trees could get preserved, one of the great things coming out of our mapping for the Eastern Band is that we've identified about 2,000 or 3,000 miles of trails total. Many of these trails are running through national forest. The National Historic Preservation Act calls for protection of archaeological resources such as Cherokee trails. So if we can identify them, turn them over to the Forest Service. Here in North Carolina, they're looking at perhaps a quarter-mile corridor on each side of a Native American trail. Well, when you go across 10 miles of national forest, that adds up to quite a few acres. And if these marker trees are found, any of them are left, that is, along the trail, they'd be preserved in this corridor. So there's a great preservation effort that's going along with our project.
Let's take a phone call from Bill in Charlotte. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was just listening. I'd never heard of this before, but there is a trail marker in Wingate, North Carolina. It's on South Main Street, and I was always told when I was young growing up there that it was an Indian trail marker. As far as I know, it's still there. It's on South Main. Of course, Wingate University is located down there, and it's... I would say off of 74, it's probably about a mile down on South Main Street, and if my recollection serves me, it seems to be pointing north.
Are you guys aware of this tree?
No, I'm not, but let me just point out that on the Mountain Stewards website, www.mountainstewards.org, we have a place on there. If you go to the left-hand side, you'll see National Trail Tree Project, and you can go in there, and you can submit trees for consideration to go into the national database. And that's where most of the trees come from. People from all over the nation send me trees, and then I evaluate them. And then if we have a need to go look at the tree particularly close, we have people all over the nation that are, if they're nearby, we can send them to go visit the tree and look at the thing and get it. And also, by the way, we don't share that data publicly. We did at one time share data about the trees, and we found out people were going and destroying them. So we do not do that anymore. But we protect it, and the trees will, we'll be protected as much as we can.
What's the name of that site again?
www.mountainstewards.org, O-R-G. And when you submit the tree, it'll come to me, and then I will dialogue with you about it. And like I say, I'm working on probably 6 or 8 trees right now in all kinds of parts of the country from people, and we go back and forth till I get enough data.
Right.
Okay.
And then I decide if we need to send somebody to go see the tree or whether there's enough there that convinces me that the tree is probably a Native American tree.
Bill, thank you for your call. Good luck with the website. Suzanne writes, I have seen the Indian trail trees in the community of Big Canoe, Georgia. Are you working with communities like Big Canoe to save the trees? I think you probably are, but what are you doing with communities to educate the public about these trees and trails?
Big Canoe area, that's just over the mountain from me. We mapped all of the trees in the Big Canoe area probably 6 years ago. In fact, one of the largest trees that's in there was we corded and dated to 1768, which is when the Cherokees were here. The Garden Club of Big Canoe put up signs on the trees to preserve them and mark them and let people know that these things should be protected.
Mm-hmm.
We also did that the same up in South Carolina. There's a community up there on Lake Kiwi that we went into and found, I think, about 15 or 20 trees in there, and they've gone out and marked those trees to protect them. So this is done in all over, and it's something I think needs to be done to let people know.
Alice writes, there's a tree like these on my grandfather's farm in Iredell County, close to a creek. I'm wondering if there are places that people can go in the Charlotte area to actually see these trees. I mean, that you'll publicize without fear of having them destroyed.
There are two trees that were found in the Charlotte area probably 4 years ago, and at the moment I just don't remember where. And they're on private property, so I really can't tell people because I don't want people going trooping all over somebody's property.
Well, what about on these trails that you're marking?
Particularly in western North Carolina, we have them, not all those trails are open. Where Lamar and I go to map these trails, but there are some cases there are trails that are opened by the Forest Service and people can find them on those locations. But right now in the Charlotte area, I'm not aware of any that people could go see up close yet. I mean, they're probably there. We just haven't had them reported.
Okay. Doug writes, I just heard the discussion mention many of the known trees have died, been removed. Has anyone ever considered replacing those that have been destroyed with new trees bent to the same shape? That would be a neat local project. What do you think about that idea?
Well, it's one of I consider one of my major failings is that when we knew all about this, you know, almost 8-9 years ago, we should have started trying to learn how to do this, and we didn't. And I think we are you still there?
Yeah.
I'm getting a beeping. I don't know what it is. Anyway, we should have started trying to do this and learn how to do it, and we didn't. And so now, today, you know, it's a long gone path, but we could start again. But
so you've never tried to do this yourself?
We never tried it ourselves to do it, to see if we could duplicate this. I've heard from a few people across the nation who said, I'm going to try to do this, but they never report back. And so I just don't know. But it's something I would love to see done. Yeah.
Well, we're impatient, so if it can't happen in 30 minutes, and this certainly takes several years to do,
you've got to spend time doing it.
Yeah.
And, also, there are people that bend trees. They're called arborglyph, I think it is, and people make funny shapes out of trees. You might have seen some of those on the web.
Yeah. Almost sculpture-like in what they're doing with them.
They're like an arbor sculpture, and so you know that it can be done.
Scientists, you use a lot of different ways to figure out what these trees are, how old they are, et cetera. And scientists evidently can tell not only from tree rings how old trees are, but in this case, almost the exact year when the shapings occurred. Is that true? I think we just lost Don. So, Lamar, can you answer that question?
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, scientists can tell from tree rings how old a tree is. But I'm told that they can also, on these trees that have been bent, using, I think it's called dendrochronology, they can tell when the tree was actually bent, right down to the year it was actually bent.
In some cases, they can. The tree rings record a lot of things. You know, how much rainfall that happened during a year. If there was a forest fire that came through, which the natives were, you know, burned pretty regularly back in those days. But they can. They can tell. One thing is for sure about these trees: they're very old. And some of the trees in the Bankhead National Forest, where I'm from, were actually beech trees that lived to be hundreds of years old. But unfortunately, they hollow out, so it's hard to date them.
Kip writes, we have one of these trees in our backyard off Scaly Bark and South Boulevard. It is quite tall with a W shape about 50 feet off the ground. And I also understand, he says, that a large wheat grinding stone is also located in the woods close by. Could that be an artifact of Native American culture?
That possibly could. Being that high up, it's... you know, it makes you wonder if they've done anything that high up in the air, though.
Yeah, Libby writes, I just Googled trail trees, and to my astonishment, they look exactly like a tree located in Mount Holly in the Tuckasegee Park. I have often walked by this tree and thought it had a very unusual structure. It must be an Indian trail tree. We have pictures of these trees up on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks and a link to Don's website. Don Wells, president of Mountain Stewards Conservation Group, author of Mystery of the Trees, and Lamar Marshall, a conservationist and founder of Wild South and Wild Alabama. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.